University of Auckland Professor of Indigenous Studies, Tracy McIntosh, works to rehabilitate prisoners. She's also a sociologist who's done extensive research on the incarceration of prisoners, particularly Māori inmates, and is part of the Safe and Effective Justice Advisory Group travelling the country to get feedback about the future of the justice system. Tracy is of Tūhoe descent, and in 2012 she was co-chair of the Children's Commissioner's Expert Advisory Group on Solutions to Child Poverty. She firmly believes the money being put into building more prisons would be better invested in the people whose lives are on a trajectory to prison from a very young age. Professor McIntosh, kia ora, thanks for coming in on Sunday morning.
Look, let me ask you something first, because we're talking off here a little bit about a restorative justice and Māori approaches to justice conference or you know, meeting. And you were talking about what happens regarding incarcerations in other countries. I mean, it's no news to our listeners that we have very, very high incarceration rates. What's happening overseas?
Well, I mean, there's a really broad range of things. Yeah. We do note in the Anglophone countries that on the whole they've got higher incarceration rates than, say, some of the other countries. So that's sort of an interesting element to consider, and there has been significant research. So, of course, the US really distorts all the figures around incarceration. Its incarceration rates are just that high.
Off the roof.
Off the roof. And but if we look at New Zealand and the countries that it likes to compare itself with generally. So if we look at Canada, UK and Australia, we have a higher incarceration rate than those countries. Interesting when you think of Australia's penal history, that we still have an incarceration rate higher. But what, you know, this was a two-day conference. The University of Victoria put it on. It was a very interesting conference. And so it had those that are working in the restorative justice place, those that are much more working in the Māori approaches to justice place, and recognising that those two things are not similes for each other. But there was a number of internationals there from Germany, from the Netherlands, from Hawaii, from Canada. And other places. And that was a really interesting one. We had Professor Frieda Dunkel, for example, who was looking at downsizing prisons and looking at the European comparisons. And so he was looking at countries where there had been a conscious decision to decarcerate, to bring the prison population down. So often we think about those as Scandinavian countries, Germany and other countries. But also looking at countries where perhaps there is not such a conscious decision to decarcerate, but where they also were seeing lower incarceration rates.
So there's no conscious decision to decarcerate, and yet...
Well, we had one of the women from the Netherlands, Professor Miranda Boone from the University of Leiden, and she was looking at Dutch decarceration and making the argument that its present decarceration or downsizing of the prison population is not actually aligned to conscious policy. So many of the listeners will know that if we think back a few decades, Holland was always used as the example of, you know, the model prison was often the discussion that was used then that had very low prison rates. But they did see a real significant rise in sort of from the mid into the 90s on, really significant rise. Never got to our lofty heights, let me tell you. In fact, was always still half our present rate, but very significant for them. And now they've seen this really significant decline. I think they're down about 52, but it might be 59 per 100,000. We're at the moment at about 219 per 100,000, though we've just seen in the last few months.
7% drop.
We've seen a bit of a drop there. So what she was talking about, that she sees it as no real conscious policy that they've dropped. So they've announced the closure of 26 prisons. And I believe I heard it correctly to say that another four have been added to that list.
Good grief.
So
they would have thrown a bit of a spanner in the works for the conference, because if there's no conscious decision and you getting these great incarceration rates, what's going on?
Well, that's what she was looking at. So she wanted to look at, and I don't think that her research is final yet, but she was trying to say, well, is it because of different policing policies? Is it because of, you know, how do we understand it? So the argument has always been made for the Netherlands that it's around a higher level of tolerance. But that tolerance was tested when they had very high levels of immigration coming in from the 1980s on. And what you do see even to today in the Netherlands prison population is a disproportionality of new migrants and ethnic migrants coming in. So you do see that disproportionality even with a much smaller rate of incarceration. You do see that there are some issues around overrepresentation. So the argument and the sort of what I can remember, even as growing up hearing about Holland, was around this, the tolerance in terms of prison very much as a last resort. Now, across Europe, and I think this is also a feature of the EU, that is seen as a standard policy, that prison is seen as an option absolutely of the last resort. You do have some strange things, though, Wallace. Like, for example, in Germany, you've got these really high numbers of people doing less than 2 months. And so you think, if you've already got a low rate, why don't you just get rid of that? You know, because 2 months would signify that in terms of the way that it's appreciated as social harm, that social harm is relatively modest. And so you would think that it would open itself up to alternative options. So one of the things about looking at these rates, and that's one of the, I guess, one of the lessons that I came away with, that just looking at rates is not adequate to fully understanding the context of the country. So in New Zealand, we don't have a lot of people coming in for very short periods of time. Now, that very low rate, when I asked him about that, he said that was both in terms of it was seen for people who, it's like nearly an administrative punishment for those who refuse to pay fines or were unable to pay fines. They were given this short period of time, and so that 3 days, but again, that's sort of an interesting one. The other thing is that the data wasn't disaggregated for remand populations. So we know in New Zealand that we have, that a lot of our rise has been attributed to significant increase in the remand population. His data wasn't disaggregated in terms of were some of those very short term actually remand individuals who were then released.
Very, very interesting. And you do learn a lot, don't you, when you compare, which is why we brought it up, you know, compared to other countries. And so here you have Holland, for example, they're closing down prisons, Ford to go very recently. And what's going on here? Since 2015, a 20% increase in the prison population, although, as you say, it has dipped recently. It's just extraordinary. What's happening? What's going on, Tracy?
Well, I think one of the things is just really, you know, and Professor John Pratt at the University of Victoria, you know, he's been always very helpful for us in understanding our particular punitive trajectory. So one of the things that he's argued is that this punitiveness, you know, which, and he's very well known for the development of the notion around the new punitiveness to understand that in the contemporary modern time. But he said, actually, this high level of this, you know, what I've called this enthusiasm for punishment, that's been with us really from the time of settling. So, and even in those very early days of settlement, visitors who came to New Zealand from Britain were surprised by it. They couldn't understand a country that seemed to be far more relaxed and had different types of mores and norm than in Britain, had this enthusiasm to lock people up.
So part of it is historic. Part of your ethos and part of your work, Professor McIntosh, is getting the voices, the real voices from inside prison to actually round out the picture, particularly voices of women, Māori women. Explain a bit more about that. That is interesting.
I mean, I think this is where I've certainly got my most insights off, is from those who have lived experience and who are experts of their own experience. So, you know, it's been over a decade now that I've worked largely with very young women coming in, young Māori women coming into the prison system. It's certainly not just an attempt only to work with Māori women, but as a Māori woman myself, I obviously have a real interest in that in terms of the generational reach of the prison, but also because amongst young women who are incarcerated, they are so overwhelmingly Māori. In fact, in the last 10 years, I've had very few who are not, who I also work with as well. So one of the things is really learning around the characteristics of their life, the characteristics of the experience. And so while the experience of incarceration and the trajectory may be specific to individuals, there are some very significant characteristics that are often very commonly seen across group of young women.
What are a couple of those?
Well, one of them is just, and I have spoken about this quite a lot, but it is exclusion from the compulsory education system. So overwhelmingly, to the point that I could count on one hand the exceptions I have to this, that these young women have been excluded from the compulsory education system by 12. I have met, just in my travels and work and other places, people excluded as young as 6. And it's one of those things we really need to think about. Whenever we see a zero tolerance policy, we really have to really think about what the impact of that might be. Now, all of us would understand why you would perhaps put a zero tolerance policy in schools around alcohol and drugs, for example, or around violence. We want our children to be in safe places. We want them to be in places where they're able to learn and where that learning environment is enhanced by a safe, alcohol-free, drug-free environment. So that sort of makes sense. But in practice, what does it often mean? And it often means that young people, and overwhelmingly there is differential arrangements in terms of that the impact of a zero-tolerance policy seems to be felt much more by Māori and indeed by Pacifica, but certainly by Māori, than perhaps other groups. But also it means if you're going to exclude someone from school, what are our expectations? How would we then support that individual? So for too many of the young women I work with, that exclusion from the school wasn't the first foot on the road, to be honest, but it was a very determining one, very, very determining element. Now, if you're from small town New Zealand, and this is a thing I've also learned, that particularly amongst the young group of Wahine Māori who are incarcerated, this young group of women that, you know, when you look at the constraints that have already been put on their life, that they come from small town New Zealand, you know, so we often would think they'd come from the large urban centres. People are actually usually older going into the system coming from large urban centres. Those that are very young coming into the system, much more likely to be from small town New Zealand. So if you think if you're in a small place and you're excluded from that school, then your ability to find, or your ability for whānau or for your guardians or for others to find an alternative option for education is really limited. Whereas if we're in Auckland, for example, or in Wellington, alternatives to education, though there's some real quality issues there, but alternatives to education are more plentiful. And in many cases, those then act as sort of holding spaces in ways that can be useful in terms of a whole range of effects. But if you're in a small town, and that option of education is gone, and all of the things that come with education, like with young men that I've worked with, often it means, for example, that you're excluded from sport. It's not that just excluded from an education, but your opportunities to really engage in sport is often very much fostered within a schooling environment.
Amazing, isn't it, when you start to talk about this, how you can see the quite linear pathway from exclusion from education right to the gates of jail.
Yeah,
I mean, to put it bluntly, it's quite marked, isn't it?
It's very marked, and and that's why people talk about the school to prison pipeline.
Right.
The other thing that we would see that I would have seen is how many of the children have been in state care. So state care been a real feature of the lives of many of these young women, overwhelmingly overrepresented as people who have been in state care, often in state care from a very young age. Other, you know, characteristics in terms of the types of trauma experienced around whānau violence or witnessing of different forms of violence. So one of the things about those characteristics is just how homogenous some of those elements are. So whilst the work of the women that I work with often really speaks to their specific experience, it also speaks to this much broader experience.
I'm with Professor Tracy McIntosh this Sunday morning talking about justice and incarceration, particularly within Māori. We actually had a chat to, again, a real expert in this area, last week, actually, Ann Jacobs, but, 40-year history. Yeah. But it was an American perspective, and it's great to have you on to round out with a perspective from Aotearoa. Mm. I'll ask you the same thing that I asked her. What are the significant differences and challenges that Māori women prisoners face that perhaps others don't?
Well, I think
children would be one.
Children is certainly one. I think the reach of it, I mean, some of them are really down at, when a man is arrested, for example, it is much more likely, though certainly not always the case, but much more likely that where he lives, his things, his clothes, his furniture will be looked after, usually by women. So it'll be a mother, it'll be a sister, it'll be a partner. Someone takes care of things. For so many of women, when they are released and they exit the prison environment, they start completely with nothing. That there is no one looking after their things. If they'd been in a flatting situation, obviously all of those things gone. So that's a really recurring, quite a small thing that people don't think about, just what it's like to constantly start absolutely at nothing. And we see this in a whole range of ways. Our connection to whānau is often a little bit more difficult. This is both a global phenomenon and a local one. You've got obviously fewer prisons for women. They're in so a lot of people would have to travel to visit. They aren't able to visit. So women are not visited anywhere near as much as men are visited because women visit men.
How about that?
So that's what I mean. I remember looking.
So those connections are gone.
Yeah, so connections can be very difficult. I remember working with a very young woman, and I don't think it was at all that her whānau didn't have aroha for her or any of those things. They lived very far away, and she wasn't visited for years. And she was very young coming into the system. I mean, years and years that she didn't have a visitor. And I think that there was a sort of a sense that they, that her family, I guess, they were having significant challenges in their own life. They were dealing with those challenges, but this particular thing of being able to actually visit and go and see her, become outside of what they felt was the possible. And so there you have a young woman.
That's truly shocking.
Largely disconnected. But, you know, I remember watching a documentary once, which was looking at California and where it's a particular carceral precinct where you've got a huge men's prison and a huge women's prison. We also are starting to have a carceral precinct, of course, out in Wiri, where we have a male prison, a women's prison, and a youth residence right in the same area, back to back on each other. Another part of the Californian experience we perhaps don't want to replicate. But in looking at this documentary in California, they had these car parks, and they just showed the car park on the visiting days for men, and it was full to overloading. And they showed the same car park on the women's visiting day, and there was plentiful places to park. So it's a much broader phenomena. And it's often those things that we think about. But the burden on women we also see in regards to extremely high victimization rates in terms of experiencing violence, often from a very young age. And whilst, you know, I don't want to in any way act as if our men who are Tane Māori and other men who are in the prison haven't also experienced much more elevated rates of victimisation towards violence, it is virtually 100% cohort within a woman's prison. We see much higher rates in terms of even dependency on substances. We see much higher rates of post-traumatic stress disorders and comorbidity with addictions and with mental health disorders. But I'm very careful when I say that because when I talk about the women that I meet with, and, you know, I meet them very regularly, weekly. So these are women, they're quite astonishing and under different conditions. And the thing that gives me most heart is the thought that we could have done things very differently, that the potential of these women, you know, focus on the young women, but on the older women as well, there was so much that could have been done. You know, I often read the poetry of the women. You know, I have a creative writing program in the prison, volunteer program, and I often read the poetry in a whole range of spaces. And I've made that argument. What an indictment it is to realise the potential of these incredible wahine Māori behind the wire. What could we have done as community, as whānau, as iwi, as hapū, as in terms of our policy and practice, to ensure that the potential of these young women was realised and allowed to flourish earlier?
Just your unique voice and insight into this topic, and we've almost run out of time, but it's so good having you on the show, Tracy. But when you talk to these people, women behind bars, I mean, do you get a sense for their hopes for the future, their aspirations, their dreams, what they want to do?
I mean, often, you know, we talk about that. I've seen for 10 years, the same woman for 10 years, and so that because they're doing very long sentences. And so I'm thinking about, you know, I do want to, often people think that there's no remorse in the prison, and I've seen very significant levels of remorse expressed within prison, though I think it's fair to say that prisons are not actually conducive for a lot of those sorts of, just because of the nature of the prison. So when people think about what it's going to be when they come out, they are also aware of why they went in and the impact that may have, especially those that are doing the long sentences. I think it's much harder for those that are churning through, that are doing much shorter sentences, where we actually have our highest recidivism rate, because in many ways they come in, they go out, and the time that you are for reflection is not there. Certainly this is not an argument that we want to put people in for a long time so they can reflect more. Society needs to find the spaces where we're able to allow people to really reflect on those and those alternatives to prisons important.
Just finally, before I let you go, in terms of what you've just said and, you know, really compared to other countries, not the US but other countries, the enormous uphill battle that we face in this country regarding incarceration and imprisonment, I think it was Moana Jackson who said in this most recent conference that what we need is something truly transformational when it comes to our prison system. Are you hopeful? Are you optimistic? Do you think we need something transformational?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, for this nation to flourish, this is an issue that we have to deal with. I believe we can absolutely show global leadership in this area. I think that when you look at places like Finland, who made a conscious decision to bring down a high incarceration rate to a low incarceration rate, there's no reason why a country of 4.5 million people can't do the same thing. And I think that we have to draw on the experience of those with lived experience. We have to reduce harm for those that are harmed, and we have to absolutely intervene. You know, I often talk about Indigenous interventions, that it's both a moral and a cultural responsibility that we have. But I absolutely believe that we can have it. And we're hearing people from a range of different life views who also recognise that we absolutely need transformative change in our system.
University of Auckland Professor of Indigenous Studies, Tracy McIntosh, who works to rehabilitate prisoners, part of the Justice Program Advisory Group, travelling the country, getting feedback. Professor McIntosh, great to have you on Sunday morning.
Kia ora.